Welcome to a podcast of Beyond the Book, a presentation of the not-for-profit Copyright Clearance Center. Copyright Clearance Center is the world's largest provider of copyright compliance solutions through a wide range of innovative licensing services and comprehensive educational programs for authors, publishers, and their audiences in academia, business, and research institutions. For more information about Beyond the Book and Copyright Clearance Center, please go to www.beyondthebook.com.
Well, welcome to another Upfront and Unscripted. My name is Chris Keneally. I'm the Director of Author Relations for the not-for-profit Copyright Clearance Center. And I want to welcome you to a discussion about how publishers should adapt to new digital channels. We're going to be looking at a specific example of that with David Packman, who is the CEO of eMusic. Welcome, David.
Hi, Chris.
It's good to have you here. And David is here to tell us some news and to issue a bit of a challenge to publishers as they look at how they're going to distribute audiobooks online. eMusic, David's company, has been a pioneer in offering customers digital content in open formats since 1998 and is the world's largest seller of MP3 music and audiobooks. After testing DRM-free audiobooks on eMusic, Random House has announced it will cease to use DRM, that's digital rights management, on its digital files, a major reversal and one with huge implications for the publishing industry. Looking forward to hearing about why they made that decision, David, but first you have some news to share with us today.
Well, this morning we announced, in addition to the five or six publishers who supported eMusic at our launch of MP3 audiobooks, and those original five or six were Random House and Naxos, Hachette, Blackstone, Penguin, and a partnership with McSweeney's, we announced this morning that 11 publishers in addition have joined us and are selling their catalogs through eMusic, their audiobook catalogs, MP3, DRM-free. So that was BBC Worldwide, Simon & Schuster, LA Theatre Works, Tantor Media, and 11 additional publishers. So at this point, the majority of large and medium-sized publishers are moving forward in this way.
Do you think the example of Random House kind of pushed them in from the sidelines?
Absolutely. We had met prior to our launch with all the publishers, and Random House was the one most interested in doing some testing and learning. And the testing, as I'm sure we'll talk about today, proved to be successful. So as you can see, they jumped head first. And as the world's largest publisher, I think that really opened the doors to the other ones coming along.
Well, the test was something that really did challenge some long-held notions about how audiobook files should be distributed online. And when we talk about DRM-free, there's an implication almost of being held hostage by DRM. Tell us about that and what the existing situation was before Random House made this move.
Well, maybe it's important for us to look at some background. We sort of put ourselves as a retailer in the shoes of the consumer. So what does the landscape look like for a consumer in the purchase of media in the digital world? Well, most consumers approach the purchase of digital media from the same angle as their experience with physical media. When you buy an audiobook or a CD or watch a television show on TV, all of those programs, all of that media is available in the clear. There are no restrictions on that content. There's no copy restrictions. There's no usage restrictions. The courts have allowed repeatedly the notion of personal time shifting and space shifting.
Right, that goes back 20 years at least.
At least. So that's the consumer experience. Now we get to the digital world where all these physical media are migrating digitally. And starting in music and then in audiobooks, the publishers and labels said, well, let's restrict usage. In an attempt to put restrictions on content so that piracy won't be a problem, let's enforce, use software to enforce rules that say you can't copy the material and you can only copy a certain number of times or use it on a certain number of devices. So the digital good is inferior in the consumer's mind to the physical one that they've been buying for decades.
And which gives a sense of frustration, I think, to their experience.
And consumers are, you know, not really philosophical, they're practical. So they say, well, I'm just not going to buy that. And so a lot of the first generation digital formats for music and for audiobooks have not been as widely adopted as the publishers and record labels would have hoped. So our point of view was, well, if you want to make a transition from physical to digital, and you want to compete with the billions amount of files that are trading every day illegally, you have to sell a good to a consumer that's at least as good as the free one, as the pirated one, and hopefully better. And the way to do that is not put restrictions on it, but to offer it in formats that play on every device and don't have restrictions like the other goods they're used to.
And that being said, though, eMusic is the number two to the number one, which is, of course, iTunes, and there they are in a proprietary software environment. But yet, from what I understand, Random House felt, again, hostage to that. Is that correct?
Yeah, so what happened in music was a single retailer became dominant in the digital world. That's Apple. They have 70% market share in the digital music download market. And there's only one other successful digital music store today, and that's eMusic, and we have about 15% of the market. And we are the largest seller of DRM-free music. And the industry came along, and now the DRM is dead in music and will be all music now sold digitally will not include DRM. In book publishing, I think Random House saw the same sort of issue. Their business was migrating from a physical world to a digital world, and yet 90% of all audiobook digital sales were controlled by this sort of single retail partnership between Audible and iTunes. And that's not in their best interest. They want there to be a plethora of successful digital audiobook retailers. The more places to sell audiobooks, the more audiobooks will be sold. So they believe that pretty strongly, and they said, how do you offer retailers an incentive to open up audiobook stores and sell audiobooks? Let them sell it in a format that consumers really want. And they totally saw it, and we've been great partners ever since.
And yet they didn't just set their media free. They did a fairly interesting bit of cyber espionage. Really. tell us about that.
Well, I think their point of view was, there's so much piracy. We would only go down this route if going down this route wouldn't materially contribute further to piracy. Because if this is going to make piracy worse, we don't want to do it. So they said, we want to do a test. We said, great. We took a bunch of Random House's titles. I think we started with 12, both sort of frontline and catalog titles. And we watermarked them with an eMusic watermark. So the watermark, is an inaudible piece of audio sounding.
Metadata, really.
Well, not really. It's buried in the audio stream itself, so it's not removable. Your ears don't hear it, but it's a little signal in the audio that says, this book came from eMusic. And then we hired some tracking firms to scour the file sharing networks and look for those titles. An interesting thing happened. They found every one of those titles on the file sharing networks, but none of them came from eMusic. So the point of view was, eMusic can sell a bunch of books, but they're not going to make piracy any worse. And I think the smart money says, if you want to compete with piracy, sell more. So they were pleased with the results and moved forward full speed ahead. And then, in fact, they went even farther than working with eMusic. They sort of announced that that's their entire future direction. And
whoever the retailer is. Yeah.
Yes, whoever the retailer is. And as I said, they really led the industry now. Just about every major publisher and mid-sized publisher has moved in the same direction.
And while it sounds surprising that there would be absolutely no files found that were coming from eMusic and any of these P2P sites, it's really not when you understand who the customer is for these kinds of files.
Sure. I think in general, audiobook customers are a slightly older group than sort of the mass digital media consumer. And specifically, the eMusic customer is an older customer. Our target customer is 25 and older. Average age is 39. So in look through that lens, it's probably not surprising that an adult customer is not spending a lot of time engaged in piracy online. Time is more important to them than money, and generally, and the time required to get familiar with rogue file sharing networks is really the domain of youth, right? So in some ways, it's not very surprising. But also, I think we understand now enough about piracy, both in the music world and audiobook world, to know that those who are engaged in the buying of media are often not the people engaged in the stealing of media. So you want to reward your good people by selling them something they want in a format they want, as opposed to punish them for being the only ones still willing to pay.
It's interesting, I think. There's a certain amount of reconciliation to a degree of piracy, and yet an understanding that you can move beyond that. It's not an either or. There will be some of it, and yet if you're working with the right customer in the right way, you can, as you say, grow your business.
Yeah, I think We know that piracy will always be a part of digital media. We're never going to eradicate it. And certainly the means to diminish it, we now have learned, are not through law enforcement or through the courts. And we now know it's also not through technology, that we've been unable to thwart meaningfully or reduce piracy in any way by the use of DRM. But the most important weapon we have in piracy is a healthy, vibrant legal market. You know, the music industry first started suffering their decline in 1999, the peak year of music sales, and they had a decline of about 25% over the next 4 years. And during that time, while it was possible to steal any song you wanted from any file sharing network, it was impossible to buy it legally. So if you wanted to consume a song digitally, you had to steal it. That was a lost 4 years of time where they weren't battling piracy by saying, oh, clearly the consumer wants the download because they're stealing it. Let's sell it to them that way. So I think we've learned a lot from that lesson.
Another lesson learned was the pricing model. I think to say that iTunes did kind of figure that out is true, you know, with the 99 cents a track, at least in the music world. You've got an interesting pricing model, a subscription model for how you deliver the audiobooks. Tell us about that and why you think that's suited to the circumstances you described.
Well, in the physical audiobook world, the cost of the books is somewhat expensive, you know, $25 to $40, but largely that's driven by the physical media costs. You need 4, 5, 6 CDs in some of these boxes. In the digital world, there's no physical cost of goods, right? The material is marginal. So you can actually afford to price it lower, but the audiobook industry hadn't, and so the digital version was selling for only a marginally less than the physical version. But our view from consumer standpoint was that they're expecting there to be some cost reduction, some savings, since they're not buying a box anymore. So we were aggressive in trying to bring the price to consumers of audiobooks down. Our pricing model is most books are $10, and you can subscribe. You subscribe to a monthly plan with us, $10 a month for one book or $20 a month for two. Now, some books are dual credit books, so you need to have some, you know, you need to be in the higher plan to buy them. But the lion's share of the books are sold effectively at $10.
And just like a book club model, which is what that sounds
yes.
like, you do things to help inform the customer about various options, where they might go if they like this particular book. You have things online that complement the actual delivery of the work itself, and a whole team of writers working on that. Again, describe that for us.
Well, I think we've learned a lot from the independent bookstore and the independent music store of days gone by, where there was lots of content expertise in the minds of those who operated or staffed the store, and that the consumer would go to the store not just for access to the material, but for recommendations, for filter, for context. And a lot of that's lost online. I think with very successful e-commerce retailers like Amazon and iTunes, they've become largely sort of search engines for media, find it, buy it. And there is some context. I don't mean to belittle that. But it's not like the context of the sort of independent bookstore, independent record store experience. We said, let's build that. Let's try to recreate the digital version of the independent bookstore, independent record store. So we hired lots of experts. We have more than 250 writers from around the world that are either literary or music experts. And they are writing sophisticated reviews that are informative, not just like, I think you'll like this, but, you know, this singer is from, we just returned from a trip from the African rainforest where we found this singer that sounds a little bit like Natalie Cole, and, you know, we think you'll like it based on this stuff. So placing some context. We did the same for audiobooks. And with audiobooks, the reviews, as you know, are not just about the book itself, but about the performance of the book, the narrator as well. And then we use the community of, you know, we have more than 400,000 subscribers who are also reviewing and putting in context and helping, you know, add some additional information to the experience. So that helps, I think, in the filtering.
And it seems to me that context is critical because what the internet does that's different than that independent bookstore, the independent bookstore had a limited square footage where they could, you know, choose a limited number number of books. Here you have the opportunity to deliver thousands of titles, and Amazon millions of titles, and that always does seem overwhelming, and yet it's what you're trying to do. You want to deliver that kind of very broad choice, that long tail, but still, so with these editors and reviewers, you've got an opportunity to have the best of both worlds, the long tail and that sense of context, that sense of community.
Right. I think there's a certain romantic notion about the internet, you know, democratizing selection, right? With shelf space being unlimited, the consumer doesn't have to select just the stuff that's on the shelf space in the retailer, in the physical world. But our experience is that just by stocking that stuff, it doesn't automatically sell. Because, well, why is that? Because the popular media is already educating many buyers about the head. So you actually have to work on selling the tail. You have to be a retailer who cares about selling the tail. Most don't. Most stock it, but they're not invested in trying to sell the tail. Why do we want to sell the tail? Because it's a high point of differentiation for us. If people subscribe to our service and say, you know, I'm discovering so many great books or songs that I never knew existed, they're likely to stay with us longer. So we have invested in building out this sort of long tail discovery process. And I'll share with you two stats I think that tell that it's successful. In the music world, we have a catalog of 3.6 million tracks, and it's mostly the long tail. We don't stock a lot of the head. Of that catalog, two-thirds of it sells at least once every 6 months. And this is a remarkable statistic because we have a highly diverse catalog, music from the African subcontinent and China and India, and yet we're selling two-thirds of the catalog. In the audiobook space, now we have a much smaller catalog. We only have about 2,500 titles so far. But to date, 96% of those have sold at least once.
And you've only been up for 6-8 months.
Yes. So the mission is being painted and worked, and it's sort of working. We want to maintain that as the catalog grows.
With the growth of the catalog, you're going to see perhaps a new forms of audiobook emerge. One of the signees recently was McSweeney's, which is a kind of very leading edge, almost bleeding edge literary journal. How are they approaching audiobooks? What are they contributing to this form that might be new and interesting?
Well, when we approached McSweeney's, they had never done an audiobook before, and they were intrigued by the idea. So we really wanted their creativity to come through. And they've kind of created a field journal. It's very rough and very raw, and it's self-recorded. You know, it's not done in some high fidelity studio.
Well, that's what's appealing to me. I think there's a certain, to my taste at least, a kind of turnoff in the overproduced audio book where it sounds like it's audio stripped off of a film.
Yeah.
It tells me too much. If I'm listening to an audio book or some drama just in the audio form, I want to feel it in myself. I want to use my imagination. I want to create the scene in the same way that I create the scene as I'm reading.
Sure. And I think that the McSweeney's material does a great job of stretching the boundaries of what audiobooks have been and is very exciting, and we've been rewarded with it. It's consistently in our top 10. And as you point out, this is somewhat bleeding edge material. It's not being discussed on Oprah's show. It's not in her book club. Yet it's a top 10 seller, and it's done very well with us.
And you also have a group called the Caravan Project, which is a consortium of university presses, and there you're delivering nonfiction. So again, in the audiobook world, we tend to think of it as being primarily driven by the fiction titles, and yet here you're finding ways to offer listeners nonfiction work, and not even traditional nonfiction. It's not Bill Clinton's memoirs.
Right.
It's something coming out of an academic environment.
And I think that's consistent with the audiobook consumer's thought process as they're getting into audiobooks. Typically, they have some downtime, like a commute, and they want to fill that with something that's different than just consuming written word or something more casual, video game or watching a TV show on a portable device. So they have some commitment to, some form of self-betterment or education. So it's not a surprise that nonfiction can do well in that scenario, and by that, not just a historical biography or something like that.
Right. It's still early days, but have the publishers learned that the audiobook sales are helping to drive the printed book sales at all?
I don't know the answer to that question because we're very new to the audiobook world. It's only been 6, 7, 8 months, as you point out. In the music world, there is evidence that, particularly among our customer, this older customer, that they use the digital world as a sampling mechanism to help decide what physical products they'll buy. But I don't know, I don't have enough information to know if whether an audiobook drives the sale of the printed work, physical work. I don't know yet. The publishers would know.
It would certainly seem that at least it might help to drive the catalog,
yep.
For major publishers like this to sort of take the leap and to go DRM free and really be out there in a very obvious way. It's calling attention to their other media, because so much of what we're seeing now, and we'll see this throughout the next few days at Book Expo, it's a book show, but it's a book show and more.
Yeah, and I think to look broadly at the audiobook industry, our view is it's too small. It should be a much larger industry. The book industry is an enormous industry, but audiobook industry is minute compared to that. There's a couple reasons for that. One is the selection's paltry. There's only about 15,000 total audiobooks, whereas there are, how many million for sale at Amazon, and about 400,000 new titles come out a year of books. So 15,000 is not large enough. And why is that? Well, if you ask the publishers, it's because there's a cost associated with making it that's not justified because not enough sell. Well, why don't enough sell? Because there aren't enough retailers. And why aren't there enough retailers? Because there's this one, proprietary one that's had the monopoly. So our view is the DRM-free move is a great move to encourage more retailers to enter the space, and some have already, more have entered, including us. And you'll have more people selling audiobooks, so you'll have more demand for them, and there'll be more that'll come on the scene. I think one interesting development is, as blogging has allowed sort of the self-publishing crowd, to publish their thoughts or information, I think podcasting, might be viewed as the primitive version of an audiobook. And there's no reason why the gabillions of amateur or even pro or semi-pro podcasts can't be sold. As right now the notion is podcasts are free. But why couldn't it be a self-published author reading his or her work and upload it to eMusic and sell that as an audiobook? So there's this longer tail, if you will, of audiobook content, I think, that can emerge over time.
Can they do that? Can sort of one individual author approach you with their work?
Today, if they've made their own, yes, we'll do a deal with them, of course. But we haven't made any sort of broad tools available to let the masses begin to upload. But that seems interesting to us, and we're studying that.
And in the same way, too, you could imagine that certain bloggers have found that the blogging experience has built the reputation for them and gotten them a book deal. I could see the same thing happening with the podcast.
Absolutely.
Free or in some small charge. To help introduce characters or certain writing ability that then get noticed by the book publishers themselves.
And maybe that's not even the goal. Maybe the goal is just to build an audience, which you could do online without the participation of a major book publisher. If you've got enough people downloading your podcast / audiobooks through sites like eMusic, and you can build that audience large enough, they can come direct to your site and download PDFs or eBooks. So there might be a vibrant, probably selective, but vibrant sort of self-published industry of material.
And any chance that just the same way that iTunes kind of deconstructed the CD and began to sell things by the track, are we going to see or are we seeing already audiobooks in shorter forms? Is that perhaps what McSweeney's doing? So they're not full-length, full-blown 10-hour listens, but really short bursts.
I can foresee it, certainly. I can't predict it. I would sort of depend on consumer behavior, but I would look at blogs as an interesting example. At this point, I think it's fair to say that the blog is a form. You may not call it an art form, but it's certainly a form. Writing the right type of blog entry is different than writing an essay or a magazine article or a book or a journalistic piece. So similarly, a podcast has become a form. And the audiobook has been a form. So will we start seeing shorter versions of, there's a trend right now among audiobooks to go to the unabridged route, which could mean, 23-hour commitment to getting through a work. But why? You know, there certainly could be 30-minute, 1 hour, 1 hour. So it's possible. We just have to watch consumer behavior and see if it goes there.
Well, certainly, internet makes so many things possible. If we wait long enough, it'll happen.
That's true.
I believe. Well, David, it's been a fascinating chat. Appreciate having you join us for Upfront and Unscripted here at Book Expo 2008. Thank you very much indeed. David Pakman is the CEO of eMusic. My name is Chris Keneally, and appreciate your joining us. If anyone has questions from the audience, we'd be happy to entertain them.
Thanks, Chris.
Anybody at all? Michael.
I'm just wondering how quickly you expect to scale. I know you just announced adopting a whole bunch of new publishers, and you sort of talk about how this is all going to go CRM-free, and yet even the people participating, some of them seem to be doing it more enthusiastically than others, and I'm wondering if you have projections or a sense of how quickly the momentum is going to go, and you know, what kind of title ramp-up
Well, among you know Random House and some others, it's full speed ahead. They're limited only by the participation of artists and authors. So if an artist or author is not there yet, Random House is going to abide by their wishes, which I think is the right thing to do. But within a few more weeks, we'll have the majority, almost the entire Random House catalog, with the Random House audiobook catalog, with the exception of the few holdbacks from respecting artist author wishes. And the same is true of most of the publishers I mentioned. Some of the larger ones who have recently come in are just, you know, maybe 6 or 8 months behind where Random House was in our view, because the sales data, I think, is what proves it, right? You wouldn't do this just for the heck of it, but in a very short amount of time, we've converted 7% of our 400,000 subscribers, music subscribers, to become audiobook subscribers, and that was very quick in our mind. So, in fact, 10% of all of our new subscribers who come in on a daily basis are electing to join an audiobook plan too, in addition to the music plan. So I think if you're an audiobook publisher, overnight to have a number two come in and deliver the royalty checks the size of the ones we're delivering, I think is a pretty exciting development, and it's just growing the industry. It's all incremental sales. So our view is we want to get as close as possible to the 15,000 audiobooks that are currently in print, but more importantly, we want to encourage them and give them an economic reason to produce more. And we're successful at growing the market, then that'll be easy to do. Instead of the hurdle rate being whatever it was, number of units sold, now they'll have more than one retailer to expect some sales from.
And do you foresee getting to a point soon where your business is significant enough that that alone will provide an incentive for all these audio recordings that are in fact not digital and not therefore not available, downloadable in any format? Will your business justify the digitization of some of the audio that hasn't been unlocked for online yet, or is it still a while before we get to that kind of scale?
Well, I think the answer is yes, I've met with many of the heads of the audiobook publishing divisions, and I think we understand what their hurdle rate is. We understand the number of units they need to sell in order to justify the cost of creating one. But remember, the cost of creating an audiobook is coming down and should come down. The number one thing that governs that is the price of the talent, certainly not the studio time, which is a commodity and small. So there is also some justification, if they know they have more outlets to sell it, to produce less expensive audiobooks, maybe using different talent at a different price scale and get more of them out there. And I think so. That's sort of at the high end. At the low end, I think, you'll see more and more of these kind of self-published folks create their own works. So our goal is to grow the number of titles. We think the market cannot grow significantly without growth in the catalog, and that's what's been holding it back.
Another question from the audience.
Do you have any plans to go international?
Well, right now, our audiobook product is available in 29 countries. So we're available in the United States, in Canada, and in all 27 EU member nations. And that's true of our music product as well. And we will continue that growth. We add at least several countries a year.
Are there any licensing issues?
The question is, are there any licensing issues? And we respect the licensing restraints or requirements on a book title-by-title basis. So if the publisher says, hey, you can sell this in Canada, the U.S., but we don't have the rights for Germany, it won't be available to our German customers.
If I can ask a follow-up to that, it's a good question. What about the audiobook listening habits? Are they different in Europe than here in North America?
You know, I don't know. We're still new to the space, and I don't know if the listening habits are different.
I'm just curious whether certain kinds of titles, it's something to look at. Good question. Anyone else from the audience? Well, it's been a great discussion. Appreciate your sharing your news about Simon & Schuster and the others with us today. Again, thank you very much, David, for joining us.
Thanks for having me here.
Thank you all for coming.
Beyond the Book is an educational presentation of the not-for-profit Copyright Clearance Center, with conferences and seminars featuring leading authors and editors, publishing analysts, and information technology specialists. Beyond the Book is the premier source for knowledge on the latest business issues facing today's dynamic publishing industry, from initial research to final publication and beyond.